Hello and welcome to this Allen & Overy podcast. My name is Amanda Thomas and I'm a partner in the International Capital Markets practice. I'm joined today by Jen Creswell, who's counsel in the same practice. In this episode, we will discuss 10 points for action and issues for consideration to help issuers and other participants in the mainstream debt capital markets prepare for the end of the Brexit transition period, which is fast approaching, of course, on the 31st of December. If you listened to our previous Brexit podcasts, some of what we're about to say may sound familiar to you, as points for consideration at the end of the transition period are very similar to those people will have thought about when we were potentially facing a no-deal exit from the EU earlier in the year. Although the UK did eventually leave the EU on the 31st of January 2020 with a withdrawal agreement in place, it's still unclear whether both sides will reach a free trade agreement governing the future relationship.
But even if there is success on that front, it is unlikely to have a tangible effect on the mainstream debt capital markets. Hence, our thinking it's useful to recap on the 10 points for consideration ahead of the end of the transition period. We should add that this podcast is accompanied by a client publication which sets out more detail on some of the things we discuss. We're also expecting further developments in some of the areas, and we're anticipating updating our publication to reflect those in due course. We'll put any updated version on our website.
Okay, so before we chat about the 10 points, it's worth remembering that we won't be facing a legislative and regulatory vacuum at the end of the transition period because the UK's key Brexit statute, the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018, ensures the UK has a functioning statute book. It onshores relevant provisions of EU law into domestic law at the end of the transition period, and various exit statutory instruments fix so-called deficiencies in the onshored EU law, so for example, removing references to EU concepts such as passporting, so that the laws work from a UK perspective. Turning to our 10 points then, and thinking first about London-listed issuers. Jen, are they going to need to reconsider London as a listing venue?
I think the answer depends on an issuer's view on eligibility of securities as collateral in Eurosystem credit operations. For debt instruments to be eligible, they have to fulfil certain specified criteria, one of which is that they must be admitted trading on an EU-regulated market or on an acceptable non-regulated market. When the transition period ends, the main market of the London Stock Exchange will no longer be an EU-regulated market. It's also uncertain whether the ECB, that is the European Central Bank, will revise its list of acceptable non-regulated markets to include London's main market. However, the London Stock Exchange has an Italian multilateral trading facility in its group, MTS Bond Vision Europe, and that's on the ECB's list of acceptable non-regulated markets. Because of this, last year the LSE announced that MTS would admit to trading London-listed bonds on the ECB's eligible marketable assets list, as long as they satisfied MTS's admission criteria.
And of course, listeners will be aware of the potential divestment by the London Stock Exchange of the Borsa Italiana Group, including MTS, in connection with achieving clearance for its purchase of Refinitiv. But we understand the LSE has been considering how to ensure the divestment doesn't negatively affect the ECB eligibility of London-listed bonds going forwards.
Yes, that's helpful. And we've got more detail on this in our publication. However, if there are issuers who really regard potential ECB eligibility as a key feature of their debt securities, then they might indeed want to consider an EU-regulated or ECB-acceptable non-regulated market listing going forward. Of course, if choosing an EU-regulated market listing, it won't be possible following the end of the transition period to achieve that listing using an FCA-approved and passported prospectus, even if that prospectus has been approved and passported into the EU before the 31st of December.
And Jen, that's a key point you mention, and one that's worth considering more broadly, I think. From the end of the year, the ability to pass water prospectus between the UK and EU under the EU prospectus regime will end. Having said that, transitional arrangements in the UK will mean that prospectuses approved by an EU competent authority and passported into the UK before the end of the transition period will be grandfathered for use in the UK until their validity expires. On the other hand, the EU haven't given a similar confirmation in respect of an FCA prospectus passported into the EU before the end of the transition period. Rather, we think that the European Securities and Markets Authority, or ESMA as it's known to its friends, will update its Q&A on prospectuses to confirm that FCA prospectuses passported to the EU before the end of the transition period can't be used to offer on a non-exempt basis in the EU or admit securities to a regulated market there. But maybe their view on that will change and things might turn out more rosy than we expect. Without any change on that front, though, what that means is that issuers who still wish to admit to trading on a regulated market in the EU or offer to the public in the EU on a non-exempt basis after the end of the transition period are going to need prospectus approval from an EU competent authority.
Yes, and I think that will be a particular consideration for issuers with FCA approved London listed retail programmes, although we know that's a smaller circle of issuers now than in the past. But those issuers will want to ask themselves whether their funding needs still require them to offer on a non-exempt basis across the EU. If so, they'll need EU approval of a prospectus. The loss of passporting is unlikely to cause the same concerns in relation to London-listed wholesale programmes, though, as FCA-approved base prospectuses for those are not in general passported into EU jurisdictions to achieve a local listing. Whilst we're thinking about the prospectus regime, the denomination of securities is, of course, key. Wholesale securities, that's debt securities with a denomination of at least €100,000 or equivalent in another currency, well, they take the benefit of key exemptions from certain obligations, lighter prospectus disclosure requirements, an exemption for offers to the public, and an exemption from the EU Transparency Directive's financial reporting requirements. So, Amanda, will the end of the transition period have an impact on denomination?
Well, it's obviously quite hard to say exactly what will happen to the value of sterling. But issuers of sterling denominated debt securities, which rely on the wholesale regime, are going to need to check when issuing that the denomination of their securities is equivalent to €100,000. And a similar point will be relevant in general for any issuers of sterling denominated securities who want to have a choice over which EU competent authority will approve their prospectus. Now, that's because debt securities must have a denomination equivalent to at least €1,000 to facilitate that. And by the way, €100,000, or equivalent in another currency, will be the relevant threshold for wholesale treatment under the UK's domestic prospectus regime after the end of the transition period. So checking the value of sterling is going to be sensible from that perspective as well. Jen, you briefly mentioned a moment ago the EU Transparency Directive. Is any action needed from a TD perspective after the end of the transition period?
Yes, Amanda. As a reminder, the EU's Transparency Directive regime requires filing, publication and dissemination of so-called regulated information in an issuer's home member state. Certain issuers currently have the UK as their TD home member state. But if those issuers also have securities listed in the EU, they will need to elect another home member state in place of the UK to satisfy EU Transparency Directive requirements. ESMA have previously covered this in a Q&A, and we expect them to reconfirm the point in an updated version of the Q&A at some point soon. Amanda, obviously we are spending a reasonable amount of time talking about regulatory regimes, but would it be worth pausing for a moment to consider the impact of the end of the transition period on standard language in documentation?
That's a very good idea, Jen. Currently, selling restrictions and legends have been following the ICMA transitional period versions, which for clarity included references to the UK alongside the EU. Going forwards, Selling restrictions and legends will need to follow the ICMA's no-deal exit versions, which were produced previously in case the UK left the EU without a withdrawal agreement in place. And essentially, they just include mirror UK restrictions and legends. Of course, the ICMA are revisiting those to ensure they're fit for the end of the transition period, and that's an exercise we're involved in. Market participants are going to need to think about how to reflect relevant changes in standalone transactions and programmes, and updating other references to EU legislation and concepts in documentation where appropriate. And programme issuers specifically are going to need to consider whether relevant changes are needed at the time of or in advance of any trade. Okay, so that's our first 5 of 10 points. Moving on to the next 5 and changing subject, Jen, are there concerns for issuers who draw up UK GAAP accounts?
Well, UK issuers using UK GAAP to list on EU regulated markets or offer to the public in the EU on a non-exempt basis will become third country issuers. And so financial information in prospectus disclosure must be prepared according to IFRS or national accounting standards equivalent to IFRS. As UK GAAP is not yet subject to a Commission equivalence decision, this means that UK GAAP issuers listing on a regulated market in the EU or offering on a non-exempt basis will need to restate IFRS if they're producing a retail prospectus or produce a narrative statement of differences from IFRS if they're producing a wholesale prospectus.
And it's my understanding that unless UK GAAP issuers only have wholesale securities on an EU-regulated market, there'll also be a transparency directive impact, because that requires the filing of annual and semi-annual accounts in accordance with IFRS. Have I got that right, Jen?
Yes, but not all the pain will fall on the side of UK issuers. We haven't seen anything suggesting that the UK's prospectus and transparency regimes will recognise EEA national GAAP accounts as equivalent to UK IFRS. So issuers using those GAAPs will have similar things to think about when listing on London.
Right. And then sticking with the UK issuer theme, are ECB eligibility concerns going to arise for UK entities?
Well, debt securities of a UK issuer will continue to be potentially eligible as collateral in Eurosystem credit operations after the end of the transition period. However, as the UK will be a non-EEA G10 country, debt securities issued by a UK issuer must be supported by a legal opinion, and that's got to be in a form and substance acceptable to the ECB. Another point to note is that if ECB requisite credit standards are to be met through the presence of a guarantee, UK guarantors and English law governed guarantees are not expected to work for that purpose. Moving on from the UK issuer and guarantor sphere, Amanda, do you want to talk about the impact on DCM documentation for EU and UK bank issuers?
Indeed I do, Jen. So in the mainstream space, most EU bank issuers have already moved to include Article 55 BRRD contractual recognition of bail-in language in relevant English law governed terms and conditions. And that's in anticipation of English law becoming a third country law after the end of the transition period. From then, it's also going to become necessary for EU bank issuers and EU banks acting as dealers, managers and agents to include contractual recognition language in their other liabilities governed by English law. As a result of that, it will be necessary to include relevant language in contractual documents, so for instance, a subscription agreement, at the point of issuance and at the update of a programme.
And I suppose it works the other way around too, because UK bank issuers will need to include contractual recognition of UK bail-in language in the terms and conditions of any bonds they issue that are governed by the law of an EU member state?
Yeah, but there are transitional arrangements in relation to the other liabilities of UK entities.
Okay. Whilst you're on contractual documents, Amanda, is it also worth mentioning that listing covenants could be reviewed at an appropriate point to ensure flexibility going forward?
Good point, Jen. It's unlikely that the transition period ending and the fact that London's main market will not be an EU-regulated market going forwards will cause an issuer to breach its listing covenants. That's because most listing covenants require an issuer to maintain the particular listing that's been sought on issue for its bonds. But it would be sensible to review listing covenants in new or updated agreements to perhaps add a specific reference to London's main market as an additional alternative to an EU-regulated market, and that way ensuring appropriate flexibility. Right, as a final point for discussion, Jen, shall we briefly touch on the exciting topic of jurisdiction clauses?
Okay, Amanda. It has for some years been difficult to assess accurately the risks involved in including asymmetric, also known as hybrid, jurisdiction clauses in documentation. The approach that EU member state courts will take to such clauses hasn't been tested in the majority of jurisdictions. There have been unhelpful decisions in some EU member states as to the validity of such clauses, and there's no authority from the Court of Justice of the EU. Having said that, English court asymmetric clauses have continued for a variety of reasons to be the popular form of jurisdiction clause in mainstream debt capital markets documentation. The position isn't entirely clear, but many of the risks involved in including such clauses appear to arise irrespective of Brexit. So after the end of the transition period, parties should continue to carry out a case-by-case analysis as to whether any asymmetric clause is appropriate.
That's really helpful to understand, Jen. Just to add, we've got further information on the topic of jurisdiction and governing law in client publications on our website. I think that's all we wanted to cover. So all that remains for me to say is that we hope listeners have found this a useful high-level discussion of points for action and issues for consideration on the mainstream debt capital markets front as we approach the end of the transition period. And that's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from her.
Oh, that's very two Ronnies of you, Jen.